Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of The Theory Club. Thank you so much for listening, for tuning in. We're so excited to chat with you today. Emily, how are you?
We just happened to be recording during my finals week. So it's a very stressful time. I'm barely hanging in there. I have tomorrow and Thursday, and then I'm free. So.
Okay. Yeah. That is fair. We are recording the week after my finals week, so I'm feeling butterfly in the sky. I'm living. Feeling so good. It was a stressful week last week. You know, I had 4 finals plus my recital. And I'm just so glad that it's all done. So we're in, so even though it's not warm in Michigan, I am in summer mode already.
Oh, yeah. It was raining all day here in Chicago. Yes. It's horrible. And it's like, part of me wants to enjoy my last couple days down here before I have to move back home. But it's like, what am I going to do?
That's fair.
Walk in the rain?
That's fair. Okay, so you're going to be staying at home with your fam during the summer?
Yeah. You know, just spending time with my mom and everything. And, you know, I'm taking some gen ed courses to get them out of the way. My teachers overwhelmed me with violin assignments. I'll be teaching a lot more, teaching at music camp, so it'll be really fun.
Oh boy. So Emily is having a productive summer and Lydia will be asleep. That's what's happening. That is what's happening this summer. But yes, let us not dilly-dally any further. We have to get to our guest. We're so excited to talk to this person. He's a voice teacher. He's come up with a lot of really interesting solfege resources for singers. So we're going to talk to him all about his work and what he does. We are going to talk to Dan Ingles. Dan, how are you doing today?
I'm great. I'm a little too excited to be here, and thank you very much for having me. Looking forward to talking about, honestly, whatever we talk about, because we could go a lot of different places.
Absolutely, we could. Listeners, again, I want you to listen closely. Turn up the volume, because this is another episode that came out of an email. You can email us at thetheoryclubpodcast@gmail.com because I read the emails, and Dan sent us an email and was like, you know, I'm also interested in music theory, and I also do a lot of social media stuff or editing things, and so if you need any tips on editing, you could let me know. And I was like, yes, please help me. I need help. I don't know what I'm doing. And so we got connected that way. And as soon as I found out about Dan's work, I was like, you have to be on the podcast. This is so exciting. Aww. So listeners, I'm telling you, the email works. TheTheoryClubPodcast@gmail.com. Email us. I do read them. But yeah, as soon as I saw Dan's videos and heard more about what he does, I was like, this is going to make such a great addition to the podcast. We've talked all about solfege. We did have one of our earlier episodes on some research that Emily has done, and we talked all about movable do versus fixed do, and we have a lot of opinions about solfege, so I'm so just, you know, interested in the usefulness of it, especially since we tend to prioritize it in the undergraduate coursework and stuff. So there's just so much to talk about.
There is.
Yes, so if we could start with Dan, if you could just let us know a bit about your background, whether you grew up like in a musical family, just your early musical experiences playing music or with music education, singing music, all those things, and then how it kind of led you to the career that you have.
Sure. Great question. I would love to tell you, right? So a lot of music in my family. A lot of church in my family growing up, in my extended family on both sides, there was just a whole lot of Jesus, like more Jesus than is probably healthy, for most people. And, so I grew up knowing, I mean, not only everything else that like people pick up from the radio, although I've always felt like I've lived under a rock my whole life, but I've also like, I know all the songs about Jesus, and which is great as a musician, because almost no matter what kind of church tradition you're in, there's something to pick up as a musician. There's mm-hmm. something about just getting used to singing all the time. It was extra with us, because we like would hold hands around the table and bless the food every meal 3 times a day. My parents were in like a folk band in the 70s and 80s, and just like always been really musically active. My dad is like a, even still today, he's like a mean harmonica player, used to like play the clarinet, and there was a piano. I actually upstairs, I'm in my basement now here in Colorado, but we have the piano I grew up with upstairs. Packing the piano when we moved out here from Massachusetts was the central project of packing the truck. Giant truck. And the whole center of the whole day was getting the piano in there, and everything that goes around it and where it goes. So, I mean, music, that's a nice concrete analogy, because music has really always been the center of my moving truck.
Oh.
My sister, so part of my story then also was my sister is still today 3.5 years older than me, and that's a great age for what happened in our household, which was she was always playing piano music that was 3.5 years ahead of me, so I could think about that music and I could like enjoy it and appreciate it as I heard it wafting through the halls, but I couldn't like sit down and play it yet. So I always like was interested in what my cool big sister was doing, and I always wanted to absorb it, and I did absorb some of it. And then, you know, her old piano books were lying around, and the stuff she had been exploring was lying around in the living room, and it was normal and right in our household that like someone should just pick up the music book that was lying around and start badly playing it. So that's what I did.
Right. So could I ask, so did you both choose to play the piano, or was that something that your parents were like, you're gonna take piano lessons? Or
no, we both wanted it. We both wanted to. I mean, of course, there, even for a kid who like who loves the piano, I think for most, and I, you know, I teach piano now, so I kind of see this, like for almost all of them, there is a little bit of like the parents provide some of the structure and like remind you of the choice that you made basically every day. You know, even though the kid, quote, wants to practice, end quote, the kid really wants to watch TV.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, until at a certain point you really get the bug. And then, you know, once we got the bug, but for us, it was pretty easy for us to get the bug for both of us. And she and I are both now professional musicians. And, you know, for a while we were doing almost exactly the same things.
Oh, Dan's sister, come on the podcast.
She's wonderful. She's great. We actually just did a song together. She did a graduation song for a preschool she used to work at, graduating and moving up to kindergarten, which mm-hmm. is just adorable by itself. But the kids all, they are sort of like polled and asked for what they think kindergarten is going to be like. And then they... So their quotes become the lyrics of the song, and she writes the song, and then I provided the bass. And I think it came out pretty nice. So we do get to do stuff together. We have, you know, a bunch of songs we sing together and play together and stuff. So it's I not only have a sister but also a colleague, and that's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so being a musician is kind of normal and never unusual in my extended family.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I really got interested in, I mean, I guess I'm the authority on this. I guess I should know. I really got interested in music seriously in high school after having it be, you know, one of the things that held my attention, you know, earlier in life, but really got into it in high school, both because I had a fabulous choir, public high school, but a really terrific choir that was traveling to Europe every 3 years, and I got to go, and the year after I graduated, not that I'm bitter, they went and sang at Carnegie Hall.
Ooh, they were like, we're gonna wait till Dan leaves.
Exactly. But I also had a terrific music theory teacher and program at the high school. Wayne Scarborough was the teacher who really got me to fall in love with music and with the craft of music, how it's written, what makes it up. And, you know, we could talk for the whole episode about what is music theory, but whatever music theory is, I fell in love with it in his class. And then I took the class again and again. And I started writing and really fell in love with composing and arranging, and did a bunch of my own arranging for whoever I was playing with. And so by the time I got to college, what was really cool about this high school is I really had a lot of what many people get in a conservatory education at the end of high school, in just a public high school, not mm-hmm. like I was in some special academy. I was just going to class with all the mean kids and then I found the nice kids, you know, because I found the music kids, and that really was where I felt safe and at home. And so I really got to college and went, you guys don't all know this already?
Oh, you were that kid. Okay.
I mean, I didn't say that, but I found myself in a situation where, like, I have, like, 2 years ago, I was dealing with better challenges than this. And I had a lot of support. You know, what you want, I've thought about this a lot, like, everyone has a different experience and a different agenda, but I think one of the things that's really valuable about a great conservatory education, if there is such a thing, is having, you know, faculty who know you and challenge you mm-hmm. and can support your growth, and also a peer group that can know and challenge and support you. Mm-hmm. Of course, many people, whether they're in a conservatory or any other environment, they long for that kind of community education and don't get it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very sad. I mean, y'all going to school right in the middle of COVID, we should talk about that, right? This is a really great time for me not to be in school. Because right. those things, like, I really am a social learner, and I love the things that I've learned in community and the knowledge and wisdom that I've gotten to socialize. Mm-hmm. And for my students, I've loved being able to provide that for them when I can. So a lot of those things were present in my high school in really kind of a miraculous perfect storm.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
But what specifically did you choose to major in?
In college, so I went to Hampshire College, where you design and label your own major. So I didn't have like a, but it was funny because I was sort of Hampshire College on its head, because I really, once I got there and realized I didn't really want to study philosophy because that meant studying like Locke, Kant, Hume, and Descartes. And that's not what I really wanted. And once I really realized that my bag really was music, I also realized that I wasn't necessarily at the most advantageous place to study music. So at Hampshire College, you really do. It's really all about designing your own major, your course of study. You create a concentration, and you have to pitch it to your advisors, and you name it what you think you should name it. And so I wrote down Instrument of Peace, Musical Studies with the Blinders Off. That's what we called my major. I don't know if that was necessary, but it was, you know, that's what felt important to me at the time. And I don't regret a bit of it, but essentially what I did is I packed into it as much of a, I went and got all of the, you know, the 8-semester plan from all the schools I could find. What do you make your music majors do? What do the performance majors do? What do your education majors do? And I really I wanted to cover all of it, because since I was at Hampshire, where no one expected a good musician to come from, I had this chip on my shoulder because I really wanted to be a good musician. And I didn't want anybody to find out I was from that school and then say, oh, don't take him seriously, he can't really play. Mm. So I really felt like, you know, I had to prove myself, and it was the way I put myself through that experience was a very arduous, like often lonely, like hard work situation where I didn't have like 40 people who were who were doing the same thing as I was, and I mm-hmm. knew them and they knew me and we came to each other's recitals and that kind of stuff. That's what I didn't get that at all. I had to sort of go out and try to find it. And so I did a lot of thinking about what it should be because it wasn't handed to me. I mean,
let's get this straight.
A lot of things were handed to me, right? But one thing that wasn't handed to me was I didn't have this like community that was just there in the building and I had to show up for it and it was going to lift me because there was it, that wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting because, yeah, like you were saying earlier, as far as you thriving kind of in those more social environments, but then to not have anybody, quote unquote, yeah. in your major or who's right. taking all the same classes, because I mean, in my experience, and Emily, you can speak to your own experience, but you know, if you are a voice major, you know, you have classes with all the other voice majors, and then, you know, you're basically all on the same schedule. It's, yeah, kind of like being in grade school again or whatever, where yeah. you're just all going from the same place to, and you spend 10 hours a day together, and that's just like the thing. If you're in an orchestra or a choir or whatever, you spend a lot of time in class together, but also doing a lot of extracurricular things, like you said, going on tours and performing. So it's like time in class, time outside of class with literally the same group of people, for better or for worse.
Right. Which... you get sick of each other, right? But also, yeah. like, you also get to watch, you know, what's really great about that and why it's so rich for a lot of people is, like, you don't just learn from your own stupid mistakes. Like, you watch this person in exquisite detail make their stupid mistakes, and you get to learn from them. And, you know, and, like, you see the kind of repertoire that works and doesn't work for different people, and you see the kinds of, like, you know, one of the things that happens a lot, I think, in high school choirs is the, I hate this song, so I hate this choir, so I hate this director, I hate this whole experience. And what really happens is 4 weeks later, the person bonds with the music and figures it out, and that attitude totally changes. Like, I hated this until I got it, and now I can't put it down.
Mahler 3.
You said Mahler?
Yeah, a lot of people Mahler have had 3. That experience with Mahler, right?
I just had it like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, so. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had that with a lot of both instrumental and choral and solo vocal music. I remember, I mean, speaking of Beethoven, I was having a lot of trouble bonding with Beethoven. And as a vocalist, I mean, do we all feel that? Because he's not Britain, you know what I mean? So.
Yeah, but, not the but, most fun to sing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a little bit. It's so funny because he's so exquisitely musical with many instruments, but he doesn't always feel musical. He doesn't feel vocal. So I'm not sure why we got on that tangent. But yeah, I know. But Emily, you were like, yeah, I feel that with Molly. And so you get to watch people doing different things like that. And instead of having to go through all of the phases of idiocy and slowly maturing yourself, you get to watch other people do it,
mm-hmm. right?
You know, and just, I mean, ideally you grow faster because you only make 1/10 of the mistakes that you would have had to make if you were by yourself.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, definitely. That's what's great about, we have like a small community here at our school. And it's great. And like, I feel like I haven't truly appreciated it, because going back to what you were saying about, you know, COVID learning times, that happened to be my very first year of college on my undergraduate. That's like all online. And it's funny because now, after having my entire sophomore year in person, I realize how much I missed out on my first year, because I didn't really know. I didn't know what college was supposed to be like. And it kind of just felt like a gap year, basically, between, wow. you know, high school and then finally being here. But yeah, the one thing is, you know, the community, and it's still hard for a lot of students here that I've talked to, is we have that community, but we're not making the most of it because we're so used to being isolated, and it's hard to click with people and make friends. Like, that's one thing. I'm in therapy now. That's one thing I've been working on with my therapist, and is trying to, like, you know, connect with the community that we have here, because it's so great being with so many other musicians. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Right. But when you've gotten to know them for this long, it's almost that, oh, no one's going over to rescue that person, therefore they must not really need help, so I'm just going to keep walking. Oh, like, oh, we're socializing and I guess we're not friends, so I guess we must not be friends, so I won't try to make friends with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the thing that's weird working at. It's like, oh, I've been with you in classes online last year. I saw your Zoom square and now like you're sitting next to me, but we barely talked this whole year, but I'm going to try to make friends with you now. And so it's that weird kind of bond thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Emily, can I ask you, because the setup situation that you had at your college, Dan, as far as having to kind of choose your own adventure when it comes to your major and things like that, how does that sound to you, Emily? Would you be interested in attending a school like that?
100%. There are classes this semester too, it gets me going, that I don't think I should have had to take.
Oh, I'm doing a roast of names.
What are they?
I'm doing a double major, so I'm doing, you know, performance and education. And I mean, okay, if I were to say one, for example, is like, I forgot what it stands for. It's called ARDL, and it's basically like arts community like education stuff here, like the Merritt School of Music, like downtown, you know, which is cool and everything. But like, it's great to learn about, but I don't think it should have been required to meet 2 days a week, 2 hours, and like with all the assignments. Like it didn't really like with what I need, you know. It's like, it's little things, you know, like that in a few of my other classes. But for sure, if I could have done that, I mean, I wouldn't have like goofed around with it and chose classes that, you know, I didn't think were meaningful. You know, I would have really took advantage of that. And I would have made sure I learned what I think I need to learn to do what I want to do after I graduate. So yeah, that sounds really cool. Yeah.
That's so interesting, because I'm kind of the opposite. I would be like, what do I do? And be like, I need someone to tell me what to do. I'm not the expert. Y'all are the experts. You're supposed to train me to be a professional in the real world. I don't know what that takes. So like, just tell me what classes I need to take. And there were so many classes, you know, that were required that I did actually end up really liking, that like I would have never taken a composition class, but because I took it, or like a music technology class where we had to like mess around with like GarageBand and Sibelius and things like that. That's not something that I ever would have done of my own volition, but I'm glad that I took them. So I'm sitting on the opposite side of like, I don't know. And certainly I have classes in my current PhD program where I'm like, that was not necessary. But in general, perhaps I'm just not as adventurous as the two of you, because I would be so intimidated with like, well, I don't know what I want to take. I don't know what I want to do. What if I take this class and that was the wrong class? And that would stress me out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is pretty common to a lot of people at Hampshire College and other places where it is more of a, you design your own major. It's not the only place. But I think a lot of people go through kind of an existential crisis when they find themselves in this environment where no one is telling you which 20 classes you have to take.
Especially at 18? Oh, I did not know.
And I kind of really felt like that, because I was like, you know, and I did. I went away after four semesters, I went away to the Crane School of Music, and I didn't think I was coming back. And I loved it there at Crane in a very different environment, an extremely structured environment, very supportive, right? Not draconian, but it was, you know, it was the typical music school experience where like you're carrying 22 and a half credits this semester, and this thing is half a credit, and this is 1.2 credits, and you're in classes from 6 a.m. till, you know, 5 a.m. and you know, you're in every ensemble and playing at every extra thing, and you know, and you see the same 10 people all day. Mm-hmm. And I kind of craved that after a while, because I found that I felt like I had been wasting my time by my own metrics, because I felt like I wasn't, you know, at a liberal arts college, it's more typical to have a class that carries 4 credits. Mm. And at a conservatory, you're lucky if your classes carry 3 credits. Right. They're usually 2 and 1, and your whole day is these, you know, and at the end of your undergraduate career, you're glad you took all those classes, but you're like, how on earth did I do that?
Literally.
Now I play 17 instruments and I don't even know my mother's name. Like,
Totally.
So, you know, I guess I've made lifelong friends, but we never hung out, you know. We just went to Oboe Tech together, and, like, now we're friends.
Literally, there's no time. You hang out in class. That's right. When you hang out. Yeah, so when did you, after you ended up graduating, how did you kind of find yourself navigating starting your voice studio and all the things that you do now?
Yeah, well, at Hampshire College, the story of which classes I took where is very complicated, and I won't bother you with that. But so at Hampshire, you do a final, an independent project all year long in your fourth year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a little more than a senior thesis and maybe a little less than a master's thesis, but it kind of depends on who you are. Some people do two. They're called your Division 3 or your Div 3. So my Div 3 was to... I wrote a book on the acquisition of musical ability, the nature versus nurture argument. And it was right around the time when K. Anders Ericsson was coming out with the 10,000 hours stuff. Mm. And it was kind of new at that time, and that was kind of a big deal. And Carol Dweck with her implicit self theories of ability, that was really big and influential. The originally it was called the entity theory, the belief in I'm talented or I'm not talented, or I'm talented or I'm not talented, or the incremental theory where you believe that your ability is going to be grown and learned, and how especially they differ in how they respond to failure. Because if you experience failure and you believe that it indicates you weren't talented in the first place, you're likely to kick the ground and cry and give up and never try again. But if you experience failure and you believe that it's a sign you need to work harder, and you're like, oh, hey, feedback. I got feedback. I guess I need to learn from that. And, let's see. Okay, let's regroup. And maybe I need to change the way my hands are approaching this instrument. Or maybe I need to sing earlier in the day instead of later. Or so, like, instead of like, oh, God, I wasn't cut out for this, you just go, oh, now we dance again. And you figure it out.
Mahler 3.
Yeah, that was, I love that stuff. So part of that project was I was actually, my advisor put me up to it, Becky Miller, wonderful, wonderful mentor to me. And she said, you know what, if you can talent yourself, maybe you should be able to talent someone else. Why don't you take some students? Me? I can't take students. I don't even know how to sing yet. Right. I had no idea. I didn't think I had anything to offer. And my voice teacher said, yes, you do. Get ready for your first lesson. I'll see you next week. What are you going to teach in your first lesson? I don't know. And I wrote down, you know, breath support, more breath support, and drop your larynx and more breath support. And that's what I was told. And that's what I thought I knew how to do. So I did. My very beginning, all the novice voice teachers, we all line up and we say, now, if you can sing this Italian aria, you can sing anything. And
we
I
love
told people
it.
That for a little while.
Caro mio ben.
Exactly.
Yes.
How many people did I teach caro mio ben? But I did. We did get good results, mm-hmm. right? We got them to go somewhere. And now I look at what I told them and I say, God, that was malpractice. I mean, you should have been booed out of the stadium. But thank God I didn't hurt anyone that I know of. And they all seemed to be happy with what we did. So that was the metric that I used for the first semester is like, does this person think they're making progress? Because I think they're making progress. And over time, I just took more and more students. Just, you know, the first semester I had 3 and then I had a few more. And so that along with I was back at Hampshire while I was studying at UMass to do the music educator licensure for sure. And they're, you know, 5-10 miles away from each other. So it's really close by. And I was at Hampshire and I was being the assistant director for the choir, which was a great opportunity. And I was also the music intern. And so I was teaching intro aural skills. And intro aural skills is where I really learned how you take someone from being a complete novice who maybe just got roped into taking this class because it was the only thing that fit, et cetera, into someone who can think like a musician. Mm-hmm. And that's where the part of my whole life's work that's, I'm going to take people who know this stuff from the radio and turn them into musical thinkers. And I got to struggle with a lot of people, many of them who genuinely wanted to learn what on earth a major chord is, and some of them who, of course, because they were 18 and knew everything, they were like, you know, oh yeah, prove it. What is this going to do for me? And I mean, I was like, of all the things to have attitude about, you chose music theory. Okay, fine. That's fine. But I had this one hater who was really just like throwing tomatoes the whole time. And, but he got my goat for a couple of days. And then I was like, all right, he's just decided he's going to be a jerk to everyone. I'm sure I'm not the only person. I know it's harder because I'm just 3 years older than him, but whatever. Like, this guy's obviously just, he's like out for blood for no reason. Almost everybody in that class, though, I got to see how aural skills develop from a total novice. And many of them had no interest in a career or playing any instrument. They were just kind of like, well, you know, I've always been sort of curious about how that works. Mm-hmm. The class was called Musical Beginnings. And it really was. And it was wonderful because I really got to turn them into people who could sight sing. They couldn't sight sing everything, but I could give them something. And what they had at the end, I knew it was what we had built together. Mm-hmm. It was really fun to watch that. And it was there. I remember giving them a dictation. It was, I was alone, I took a ride, I didn't know what I would find there, which is in G flat major. And it's in, like, if you're really going to count it, it's in, like, 12-16, right?
Sure.
So I put this up on the board. I'm like, okay, I wrote the first couple of bars of this in G-flat major, and you guys finish it up. Guess what? It didn't go very well. I didn't know. I thought it was obvious, you know? But I really had to learn, like, oh, I got to get with where they are and what they really can do, and that might be 4-4 in C major. And so I want to challenge the people who need the challenge, but I don't want to lose anybody just because I picked something in G flat major in 12-16 and they can't do that. I don't want to lose any of them just for that reason. Mm-hmm. And I got, because of that, I don't know how many semesters I did it, 3 or 4. I got a lot of love out of doing that with these kids who didn't necessarily have any interest in music beyond passing the class, but we just did something fun together and they loved what we could do. Mm-hmm. So that's where Dan's Solfege Trainer really started. It's like the private studio of a guy who's carrying a heavy backpack around and teaching all sorts of different people who are studying all sorts of different things in their private lessons. And then a bunch of, you know, 18 and 19 year old novices whose commitment to music isn't very deep. Mm-hmm. And that, melting pot, that experience for me really helped me get to know the way musically basically uneducated but reasonably intelligent adults think about music when they start. And let me tell you, I've never run out of interested but musically uneducated, reasonably intelligent adults. They're everywhere. And I could very easily work with them forever. And I love people in that camp. And you know who's at the same level is people who are 15 and are curious about what happens in their high school choir. And they're everywhere. And so the way that a musical mind is constituted from the ground up has always just been really fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. If you can't sight sing that, why can't you? Mm-hmm. I want to know, like, what keeps you from being able to pick up this, you know, piece of elementary level sheet music and be able to read it. So I've tailored a lot of these exercises to specific problems in order that different people I've worked with have had. that's kind of where they come from.
Yeah, yeah. That's so interesting because, you know, I'm in a similar mindset as far as like being really fascinated by those early stages of learning music and learning music theory, because I also had such a great experience during my undergraduate sequence with my teacher, and I was experiencing that same phenomenon of like, oh, we're all in the same class, but I'm having like a radically different experience than my colleagues, and like, where is that coming from? How is it that like I'm like, you know, starting to make connections and these things are beginning to click for me, like so many concepts that I had wondered about throughout my musical upbringing, but I'd never had the terminology, had never really been able to name, right? Like learning, you know, the term diatonic for the first time, like, oh, that makes sense. And, you know, I'm connecting these dots, and all of my colleagues, not all of them, but, you know, a lot of them were, you know, it took them a bit longer. They were struggling, or they just didn't find the process as enjoyable as I was finding it. I was like, are y'all seeing this? Is everybody, are we in the same class? Like, I just remember being so excited and so many of my colleagues being like, yawn, I don't want to be here, I don't want to do this, this is pointless, it doesn't make sense, it's not going to help me as, you know, a percussionist, or it's not going to help me.
It's not, of course it is. You want to play timpani, don't you?
Emily's a star timpani player, she's coming up on the timpani.
I had to take percussion techniques this semester, and for some reason they said I was good at it, so...
Because you have an ear. You have to have an ear to play strings, and you're no, but it's like a pianist who feels like they don't need to learn how to sing because the notes are always right there for them. And you know, some pianists don't become excellent singers, some pianists don't develop a great ear because everything is there for them all the time, and they never have to come in on that A flat and be like, oh, that's not in tune, hold on.
So it was just such an interesting experience, and so I'm also really, really fascinated by those early stages of like, oh, what's not connecting for you, how do we figure that out, or, you know, coming up with multiple ways to explain the same thing for different types of learners, or to make it relevant to different types of instruments, to different genres of music, you know, things like that. So it's just such a, you know, as I think about my future career, I don't really anticipate myself at like a big research university where I'm advising PhDs. I'm much more interested in and attracted to like the undergraduate sequence and those beginning stages of learning, and like, how do we make this a cohesive experience that hopefully you enjoy, even if you don't, you know, fall in love with it like we did. Can we still make this like an enjoyable, pleasant experience for you, where you do feel like you learned something, and where you do feel like you have musical tools that you can take into your future career, whatever that might be, whether it's performance or education or performing arts technology, if it's producing or if it's whatever, like that you just still have those tools, and that it doesn't feel like pulling teeth, hopefully.
Yeah,
no, it's funny. This is kind of going off into something else, but about solfege, I had a very interesting conversation today with one of my friends who has been with me since theory one, theory two, theory three, and now we just finished theory four. And my theory professor who taught our first three semesters, and we were talking about, because we have our final singing exam tomorrow for like our atonal, you know, theory. And we were talking a bit about like the use of solfege and like how that's changed our opinion on it from, you know, theory one all the way through. And I've always loved solfege so much. And it was funny because my friend like couldn't stand it and hated using it. And now that we've came around to theory four and like, we can't really use it at this point. Like you can, but you know, it's not going to really help, because we were doing movable do. There's like two kids in our class that were doing fixed do, and my friend said today, she's like, oh, you know, I wish I learned fixed do, but you know, she kind of realized that partway through the semester, and she was like, well, it's too late now because we're like at the very end of this, and she kind of wished that she had like tried that and like nurtured it throughout, you know, her experience in theory and then used it. I mean, I like movable do. I've always liked solfege, but I thought that was interesting on how her opinion of solfege has changed, because she hated it at the beginning.
Was it one of those, like, you know, I don't understand Mahler, so I hate Mahler?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, of course you would have this, I mean, if you don't understand something that you have to work with, of course you're going to have a negative experience of working with it mm-hmm. for a while. Of course, but you know, but what, you know, as an educator, I'm looking for that kid who feels like they hate Mahler right now, or feels like they hate movable do or fixed do right now. And I'm looking for like, okay, at the least, I don't want to lose you, but I really want to help you. I want to give you all the lifelines I can possibly give you so you can find your way as a learner with your brain, with your process, find your way through so some of this stuff starts to make sense to you. And of course, we all do it differently in different ways. What, so how has your, you talked about your friends, but how has your experience with your own aural skills tool set changed? Like, where are you now? You said, oh, we can't use movable dough because you're doing such atonal stuff, or like, what do you reach for right now?
Well, it's interesting because I had like no, I never had taken music theory before. I've only been playing violin. It's about 8 years now, but you know, I started when I was 12. So, you know, I'd never taken any theory classes. Like my school and high school never offered it. So like college, it just kind of hit me. I tried doing some own, like of my own written skills before I started school here, but you know, aural skills was not a thing. And that hit hard when I came here because most people had been playing since they were like five. And so their ears were already like, you know, adapted to music and identifying pitches. And so it was bad in theory one. Lydia knows it was bad.
That's how we met. That's the Theory Club origin story.
Yeah. So, you know, I worked because Lydia was my TA a lot with her and then my professor. And I just like drilled myself into it. And then I was injured also during the pandemic with my arm. So I had to have surgery, like overuse injury. And I couldn't play for a bit. So that's when I did an aural skills research paper and I really just dived into it. And so then in like half of theory two and theory three, it was all breeze. And then theory four, it's been, I can't really say much about it. It's been a mix of things because now I had a different teacher who's totally different. And then we're doing like atonal music and like all this different stuff. So it's been a struggle this semester. But if we think about one through three, things have definitely gotten better. And I think it has a lot to do with, well, Lydia and the professor that I had, because as you were saying, they were always like throwing those lifelines at me. So I didn't, you know, want to give up or like, you know, I kept trying and I'm so thankful because I could totally tell the difference. And when I'm hearing notes, I can identify things like so quickly now and chords and everything.
Great. Yeah. Well, boy, congratulations coming from not having much of it formally in high school and then feeling like you were on top of theory three and aural skills three. That's a quick long journey.
She was always that student who was like, oh my gosh, I'm so worried about the test, and then she would get like a 92 and...
92. Oh.
Yeah, that's me. I'm like, oh no, I'm failing, right? Hi, welcome to Dan's Solfege Trainer. I'm Dan Ingles with the Dan Ingles Voice and Piano Studio. In this series, I will introduce you to movable do solfege in all its glory to help prepare you for all your future singing. Singers who use solfege sing in better tune, find their notes quickly, rarely get lost, and learn music easily. And in these videos, you'll learn why. Step by step, we'll get you singing intervals, triads, then seventh chords, chromatics, minor keys, and key changes. You do not need to start with any background, reading music, or playing an instrument.
Yes, so let's transition to talking about the work that you do now and the resources that you're putting out on the internet. So first, let's talk about this book.
Sure.
So how did Dan's Solfege Trainer come to be?
Well, it's a curriculum. It's a work of pedagogy, and it's a work of, you know, it's a body of curriculum that I have just used and evolved over a long time, many years. Started out with just a couple of earworms that I thought were fun. Exercise 2D is this one. Do do re mi mi fa so fa so fa mi re 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 mi fa fa so la so la so fa mi 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 fa so la ti la so fa so la ti do ti do ti, and so on. You go all the way up, you go all the way down, and then and I just thought that was so irritating and catchy. I had to learn it, and so pretty soon I got pretty good at spitting out those syllables in sequence. That was from one of my wonderful mentors, Lainey Broad Ginsburg, who helped me really. She was directing the Hampshire College Chorus, and she really took me under her wing and told me, like, you need to take this stuff seriously. You're going to be my assistant director now. You're going to play parts for sectionals. You're going to conduct a song. You know, we're going to do your arrangement, and you're going to go home and learn this thing. And she sang that to me, and I stole it and used it ever since. But I learned that, you know, like I was finding, I would often, when I was beginning to teach, I would often overshoot the abilities of my beginning students. So I realized that a lot of people couldn't do it. They just didn't have the background with just singing the scale. Mm-hmm. So I had to provide a scale. And then I realized also that, like, why did I have to search high and low throughout the world to find the chromatic solfege syllables? The up ones and the down ones. Why did it take me like 3 years before I had a document that I could start to use them with? Before I had like, oh, that's what they are? Because, like, I mean, you guys are babies, but before the internet was in its, you know, current form, you couldn't just like, oh, I want to learn about that and type it into some device. You had to like find someone smart. And that was pretty difficult in certain circles. So, you know, to get nerdy information about music theory, that was, I mean, you didn't know where to look. And if you did know where to look, you didn't have time to go that far to go look for it. So I really wanted to give, you know, I wanted to answer that question. So I would just developed over time more and more stepping stones. And of course also more and more harder ones at the end. Because once I learned how to do something, then I myself wanted the next challenge. And if I would teach it to somebody, then they would want the next challenge too. So, you know, it developed in both directions, and it got a lot more granular in terms of, oh, this was too easy for you, but that was too hard for you. I'll see you next week, because I just got an idea. And they're still developing. I found that I needed a way to introduce the, I wanted to introduce only the ascending chromatic syllables. And so I found that at first I had a really inelegant way to introduce them that didn't work for people who were not used to them, but it was a nice challenge for people who were already really heady about it. So the hard one was do ti do, re di re, mi re mi, fa mi fa, so fi so, la si la, ti li ti do. And that's fun if you already have all this stuff in your head. But if you've really never understood the difference between a diatonic lower neighbor and a chromatic lower neighbor, and you really have never heard it, much less have to produce it and do it in time and come up with the right syllable for it, if your ear doesn't appreciate the difference yet.
Right.
Then, you know, and many of my students have been in that position where they're going to make that substitution error. They're going to always make it chromatic because they don't know the difference. Or they're going to always make it diatonic because they don't know the difference. They'll be 50-50. So then I came up with do ti la ti do, ti do ti la ti do, re do ti do re, di re do ti do re. Which gives you time. It gives you a contrast between the diatonic neighbor and the chromatic neighbor. And it's just more elegant. Like, you want to sing it because it feels nicer musically.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is so interesting, because it's like, even I never thought of it that way, as far as like, you know, you're looking through that book and you're like, these are just random exercises, mm-hmm. but like, it takes intentionality to put together things that feel pleasing to sing, that feel intuitive to what we already understand intrinsically about tonal music. And so, like, mm-hmm. those things have intention behind them. That's one thing that I really appreciate about your book, is kind of I'm looking through it now, and there are, like, objectives at the end of all of the exercises, as far as, like, oh, by the end of this exercise, you should be able to understand what a perfect fourth is, or whatever. So understanding that each exercise has a goal and an objective for the person that is using it, that it's, like, it's not just this thing that we're making you do just to make you right. do it. There right. is a goal. Like, there's a tangible thing that hopefully through practicing it, you can walk away from, like, knowing how to recognize this interval or this pattern, or learning just to get the syllables in your mouth in order or whatever. Like, it's just so helpful the way that you have it all laid out as far as the specific objectives behind them. And then, yeah, just understanding that they're all designed intentionally and intuitively as far as, like, what feels good to sing and what makes sense to the ear to sing.
Thank you. I'm glad you get it, because that's what it's supposed to do, right? Because we all do run into a certain very specific impasse at a certain point. And maybe for you it took you 2 hours, and for another person it took them 2 weeks. Or maybe some people, you know, maybe for somebody else that very same impasse is the thing that causes them to give up on themselves forever and go get a desk job. or in other words, it's a barrier to entry, and for some people they're able to surmount it, and some people it slows them down, and for some people they don't even realize what kind of problem it is that they have, and so they never solve it, and it just never it takes them out of the game forever. So I try to find, that's why I try to be really specific in the text of the book. You know the videos that correspond with them are more conversational, and they don't look dry, because they're supposed to be more engaging videos. I hope they don't look dry, but you know, I try to present in the book exactly what you are supposed to be able to get out of this. So ideally you can self-coach and self-assess and look at this and go, oh, I think I need work on the previous one, because it will help me break through this one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, Emily, do you have anything before we talk about the videos a little bit?
I don't think so. I'm just loving the titles of these. Thank you. It makes it so much fun. Like, I wish that I had this.
Oh, Stub My Toe is my favorite. Stub My Toe is the jam.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, it was so good. I love it.
Oh, wait, does that one? Oh, that one doesn't have the pretend impossible violin etude.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I need to update this. So 4A has, so because of Stubbed My Toe, I had somebody who was, this was actually just a couple months ago. I had somebody who was chewing on this, and he wasn't quite ready to move on and add more complexity, to add more content, but he was ready for like more chewing. So we came up with this one. So that's, so 4A, this is Stubbed My Toe. This is Do. So now, are you guys going to sing this with me or not? I mean, we're on Zoom, so it's going to be, you know.
There's going to be some lag, but I
but I really want to like jam. Okay, so 4A, if for those who haven't seen the videos yet, is Stubbed My Toe, ow, Stubbed My Toe, ow, Stubbed My Toe, ow, Stubbed My Toe, ow. And in solfege, it's Do, So, Do, So, Re, La, Re, So, Mi, Ti, Mi, So, Fa, Do, Fa, So. And then it gets cool, because then you cross the repeating point. So, re, so, so, la, mi, la, so, ti, fa, ti, so, do, la, so, mi, do. And we thought that was fun, and he had a good time with it. But then I found out that he could really enjoy do, so, do, so, do, so, do, re, so, re, la, re, so, re, mi, so, mi, ti, mi, so, mi, fa, so, fa, do, fa, so, fa, so, so, re, so, so. That one's cool. La, so, la, mi, la, so, la. Ti, so, ti, fa, ti, so, ti, do, so, do, so, do, so, do. And if you work out the pattern, it actually does, I don't know why, but it actually does end up with do, so, do, so, do, so, do, which is a nice little icing on the cake at the end. So it's really the same content, right? You have this ostinato and you're just practicing fourths and nothing else. You're not worrying about all the syllables of a triad, but you do get to build an ostinato on so. By this time, we hope that your do is pretty good and rock solid for you. But then if your do is pretty good and rock solid for you, we want to have something else that's rock solid. And of course, the next thing should be so. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know what an ostinato is, you're missing out on some fun. So there you go.
Listeners, watch the videos.
How to express the message of the music. So before we cover the minimum music theory every singer needs in exercise 1B, please get really good at this basic scale right now. As we sing this scale, first up, then down, I'll also show you the Kerwin hand signals. Low do is around your navel, high do is around your eyes. Okay. Children and unchanged adult voices, you'll start here, this is do. Changed voices, you're down here with me, this is do. Ready? Go. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. Take a breath. Coming down. Do, ti, la, sol, fa.
Okay, wow.
Forget college, I'll just watch these.
Oh, that's going on my CV.
It is Emily approved. Okay, so it's so interesting because, okay, listeners, I know you just heard some of the audio, but I'm telling you, the visuals, don't sleep on these visuals because it's giving, like, it's so helpful as far as, like, you have the piano set up so that you know what's going on, where all the keys are on the piano. You have the stab set up, and then you also have all of the solfege syllables. Like, it's just so helpful to look at. So, like, I have so many questions about how you came up with this setup as far as, like, the visuals of the video. It just makes it so easy to follow.
Oh, I'm ugly crying right now. Thank you. I'm really glad. I'm trying to give people this gift, and if somebody can get it, that's good. I can tell you, as an educator, I keep zero secrets. Mm-hmm. So I really want to give all of it away. And I keep trying to put myself out of business, and it never works. And because educators and musicians who are educators, don't worry about putting yourself out of business because the human thirst for knowledge is inexhaustible. Never worry about that. Mm-hmm. If you have a positive relationship with someone and you're nurturing them and they finish learning the thing they came for, they're not going to like want to go away now. You're their tour guide and they're going to want to learn something else. You just better be good at that before they ask you for it.
Yes, totally.
Right? So, yeah, you never want to stop.
Yeah. So how did you kind of decide on all of the visuals and stuff? And if there's any like tips for the listeners as far as like software and things that you use in order to kind of design how your videos look?
Sure. I brought, before I started really making this version of the videos, because I had sort of done some earlier versions when I didn't really know how to make videos at all. Arguably, I still don't know how to make videos at all, but I definitely make videos that are 2 years better than the ones I was making 2 years ago. I was already able to think as an educator and go, what is the right amount for the learner this is targeted for right now? What is the right amount of information? How do I make the narrative something that's kind of charismatic that the person wants to be able to follow? Because, you know, it's, of course, and I think every novice teacher who should be teaching at least goes through a phase where they want to impart too much information at once.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you never have that phase, perhaps you don't have any information to impart. But if you get stuck in that phase, you will lose certain students, and you will lose the students who most need the teacher.
Right, yes. So that is part of, yeah, the difficulty of teaching beginners is that you have to figure out, okay, what information is vital now?
Yeah.
What can we introduce later? Which is another thing that I really appreciate, kind of about the order, like the flow of your videos, is that you'll often start kind of with the exercise, and you know, you'll sing through the phrase or whatever, you'll introduce the scale, and then later go back and say, okay, so this is how it works, which I think is really effective, because, you know, especially when we're talking about tonal music, within the context of the Western scale, so much of it we're already familiar with, like our ears are already attuned to. So when you say, okay, we're gonna learn a scale, and you kind of start right off the bat with like terminology, I think a beginner might be like, I don't, you know, find it a bit intimidating. But if you start with, this is what it sounds like, you've probably already heard it in some capacity, then they're like, oh, okay, I know what that is. Doe, a deer, a female deer. I've heard that before. Right. And then you can go back kind of and, you know, connect those dots, but you have to like introduce the dots. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm always thinking about like, I'm always looking for a barrier to entry. What are the barriers to entry for this person with this content? And very infrequently is the barrier to entry, I can't follow the ups and the downs. Mm. That's really rare. It does happen. And for those people, there is no such thing as a tone deaf person. You are not tone deaf. Anyone who's listening to this, I'm really, especially if you're listening to a podcast called The Theory Club and you think you're tone deaf, I want you to know that you're not. Because if you can, right, thank you. Because if you can make your voice go up and down and your friends know whether you're asking a question even once in a while, then you're not tone deaf. You can adjust the pitch of your voice and all the rest of it's training. But abroad in the land, you will find people who are talking about the Johnny One Note and the silent singers, and they had me stand in the back of the choir and mouth the words, and you hear all these horror stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a person to go around with that belief can be very limiting, and I'm sorry for anyone who has had that experience who has been told to stand in the back and mouth the words because they're not singing yet. Any of that stuff, please, please remember it's not about you. It was about that bad seventh grade choral director who didn't know what the heck they were doing. And that shouldn't have happened to you, but you were probably also having a hard year that year because it was seventh grade and we were all having a hard year in seventh grade.
That's true.
But what is the barrier to entry? It is very infrequently that the person genuinely cannot control the pitch of their voice at all. Mm-hmm. Not never, but infrequently. And more frequently, the barrier to entry is, I think I'm afraid of music theory.
Mm-hmm.
So if you give me anything that sounds like that content I think I'm afraid of, I'm going to shut down and be unable to work. But you know, one of the most basic educator tricks is, I'm going to ask you to do something small right now. You know, I'm not going to ask you to tell me your deepest fear. I'm going to get there much later when it's appropriate. But right now I'm going to ask you what you did this weekend. Can we talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
Today, like at the beginning of the video, I'm going to ask you to sit through ideally 15 seconds of station identification. And then I'm going to get you singing as quickly as possible because, frankly, we're dealing with YouTube and people don't have an attention span. Right? You're on YouTube. You could be watching videos about Minecraft right now. And why are you not watching videos about Minecraft? To sing? You better at least not lecture to me, right? So I try to do the like, okay, we're going to sing something, you're going to be fine at it, and then afterwards we'll talk about what you did. Mm-hmm. Because then it's like, ooh, I did that. That was kind of cool. Give me the $5 word. Oh, that was diatonic. Very diatonic of me. I'm glad I could do that.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, Emily, do you have anything to add about the video?
No, I mean, I was just going to say like, I mean, I can't say I just started teaching. I've actually been teaching privately for 3 years. Time goes by fast. But you know, like, just like what you were saying exactly, like, I feel like even the first time I ever taught, the very first lesson sucked. It was the worst thing ever. I know probably a lot of teachers understand that too. And it's just, it gets so much better over time. And you notice, you learn so much so quickly, and you make so many mistakes and correct them so quickly. And so, you know, like Lydia was saying, you know, from looking at that video, I see so much detail, you know, that you're making sure for the listeners to help them learn as quickly and as efficiently and as best as possible. And like, I really appreciate that too. And I've always thought about like doing some sort of a music theory, like Instagram page or something to like, you know, cause there's not much music theory stuff out there. So
yes, yes.
No, there isn't.
It's nice to see, you know, another music theory YouTube channel. Well, I can't say another cause I know of one other one. So I guess, yeah, another music theory YouTube channel. That's, yeah, it's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm shocked, honestly, at how few, I mean, it's not like there are no resources in the world, but there are so few resources on YouTube about it. And I've found some that I think are helpful for certain things, but I really feel like why aren't I buried in competition?
Mm-hmm.
It actually kind of looks like I'm the only person on YouTube doing this. Mm-hmm. Which I think is sad. I want to be buried in competition and I want to be the worst person at it. But because I'm, you know, I'm only me. Mm-hmm. I'm only one person, but there are people, I know that I haven't found them all yet, but there are people out there who need this stuff and they want the rich visual presentation and they want to be sort of handheld through it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I also try to make each video as short as I possibly, like if I can cut it, I want to cut it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, people don't want to sit around for 35-minute videos. They want to, like, they want something that they can, like, not commit to that draws them out.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that's such a good point as far as anybody. I also haven't really seen anybody on YouTube doing what you're doing. It's not that there isn't music theory content on YouTube, but one, so much of it is written skills based,
yep.
And it's not about singing and it's not about oral skills in particular. So there are people that theorize about music. There are people that talk about popular music,
yeah,
and
yeah,
kind of, you know, pick it apart and talk about the, you know, harmonic structure, the complexity of popular music. Or, you know, I remember during my undergraduate sequence, sometimes going to YouTube and saying like, what is a Neapolitan six chord or whatever. So there's also a bit of that written
yeah,
theory
yeah, yeah.
on YouTube, but there's not really anybody kind of walking you through the basics of solfege or walking you through how to connect what you're seeing on a staff to how to produce the sound with your mouth. So like that is a niche that's like, I really feel like totally unexplored on YouTube.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sad that it is, you know, I want buddies. And, you know, I know there's some of y'all out there who have this stuff and you're thinking about putting it out there. Let's do it. Come on, get in the game. There are a lot of really great, you know, like, there's a lot of almost like music journalism and like opinions and hot takes and that kind of stuff. But really the skill building, there's a ton for guitar. There's a ton for piano.
Mm.
There's way more for guitar than there needs to be. And half of it is pretty terrible. There's a lot that's great. Right. But plenty of it, you know, when you're dealing with YouTube, you're going to deal with every level of humanity and you're going to deal with some people who, like me, you know, your first 50 videos are probably going to suck.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get better, you know, you get better a little bit at a time. I really learned how to do some of the production because the church I was working in during the shutdown, instead of playing a certain number of songs during a service, essentially we had to record that many songs on video and turn them into YouTube videos, and I would upload them one song or one title at a time. So because I had to do, you know, four or five a week, that's a lot of titles, and so I had to like almost like a TV show, like every episode has the same, a lot of the same visual elements, and you like, you fly in the opening scene, you fly in the, you know, each of the scenes, but you know, but all the transitions look the same each time.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the design is really an architecture that you duplicate and you just put in new footage.
Mm.
And that's okay. It's good because it creates an identity, and like people don't need to see all of your obsessive editing choices each time, what they need to see is the next level of the content.
Mm.
So I was, you know, I turned out, you know, hundreds of like hymns and instrumentals for these church services. And then I realized that like, that's actually a skill I can take to these videos.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's so interesting. Ooh, I just find this so exciting that you're kind of filling this niche that through, you know, your experience in other areas of your musical career. And I find it, you know, going back to what we were talking about, as well as, you know, this being specific for singing, and anybody that wants to learn to sing or that wants to learn more about solfege, whether they identify as a singer or not. Because again, it's not that this is that like movable dough only makes sense for singers. Like really anybody that identifies as a musician can benefit from learning how to sight sing, or from just understanding the relationships that like understanding the function of solfege, right? It's
right.
about explaining the relationship of intervals to each other. And so
exactly.
like, it's so, it could be so beneficial for literally anybody. Yes, even if you're a pianist or a percussionist or
Absolutely.
Whatever, because it's just about connecting, you know, your inner ear and your sense of tonality to what you're seeing on the page, being able to connect it to your hands through the hand motions, the solfege motions, and like being able to actually sing it out of your mouth. Like that's a whole musical language that you can use to communicate with other musicians. So it's just so helpful and like so needed. And it makes me so excited. Just anybody that's making, you know, music theory content, it's already a niche thing,
mm-hmm.
but this is like, you know, another level of expertise that I think is so valuable.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I hope it finds the right people. All I'm thinking about right now is just producing it, getting it out there, because I know there's more curriculum that that people need. I mean, if you are the target user of this stuff and you are done with level 4 already, you know, I'm working on it. I'm working on it, but I can't stick them all out at once because they just don't come out that fast. There are many people out there, I know there are, because I've met and worked with so many of them, who really want to know what on earth they're doing. But as singers, I mean, like I went through, they haven't found the resources when they want to do the learning.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, they can't do a music degree because they're already a lawyer and they're $400,000 in debt. Or they can't do a music degree because they didn't get in, or because they couldn't pay, and now they have to study something at a community college that they didn't want to study. Or there's so many. You don't have to be a conservatory student to want to study singing. A lot of us want to study singing. I know because I'm a voice teacher.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people want to get better at singing, like all of us. We secretly all sing. Even the people who say they don't sing, they sing. I mean, this, and the more I've studied singing, I mean, I love music and I always will, but singing is very special to the human family. It's very special to humans. It's indispensable. We will never be done with singing. We will never give it up. We'll never stop doing it. It changes forms, but it's with us forever. It's like out drinking alcohol. There's never been a human civilization without alcohol, and there's never, and not that this is an argument, but there's never been a human civilization without singing, never. And it's just part of what it means to be human, that we all do storytelling, and we all get so elevated by some of the stories that we have to sing them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's for everybody, and it should be for everybody. And I know there are people out there who need the handholding, and so I try to give them, again, help them over that barrier to entry.
Oh, Okay, so that is going to do it for this episode of The Theory Club. Thank you so much to Dan for being on the podcast.
Thank you, both of you, and listeners. Keep coming back. Thank you so much.
If you, dear listener, are really interested in Dan's work, make sure you go to his YouTube channel, Dan's Solfege Trainer, and check out his materials and his book. And if you're interested in being on the podcast yourself, I'm telling you, it works. Dan emailed us and it works. So email us at thetheoryclubpodcast@gmail.com. If you're interested in being a guest or you want to suggest a topic for us to talk about, music that you're listening to, music that you wrote, any music theory content that you're making, oh, please tell us. I would love to know. So make sure you send us an email. Make sure you follow us on the Instagram @thetheoryclub_podcast. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you have a great Friday, a great rest of your weekend, and we will see you next week. Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much.
30. Oh, wait, I said Ingles and not Ingles.
You did, I know.
We decided Ingles, didn't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did.
Damn it.
I was just going to let it go.
No, 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 no. I have to do it again. Okay.
All right.